More school resource officers, active shooter drills, teaching the school staff and students how to recognize dangerous behavior. The state's mass shooting work group has issued a list of recommendations to try to prevent mass shootings, and Chi Radio's Hannah Scott has the whole story here.
So, Dave, this work group was funded by a budget move earlier this year, and they met several times over the last several months. It included folks like the ACLU, law enforcement, people from the AG's office, and a variety of other people like mental health and people from the mental health system and things like that. They discussed possible ways to come up with strategies to prevent mass shootings in the future. Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs Executive Director Steve Strand says they oversaw this, by the way, says these recommendations are about a little over two dozen of them, 25 in total, include recognizing the importance of school resource officers or SROs and urging the state to pay for more of them. Strand says a lot of people, though, worry that more school resource officers, who are all police officers, will lead to more students getting arrested, but that the group made clear that that's not their goal in the recommendations by also suggesting new laws that clearly define the role of a school resource officer and that their focus needs to be on keeping students out of the criminal justice system.
But at the same time, something SROs do very well is that, you know, they know the players, they know the students, and it's true community policing where you know what the issues are, and I think that that lends itself to threat assessment, particularly if a student is exhibiting risky behaviors.
Now, because all school resource officers are cops, they are also all armed. And while the group did discuss the possibility of having armed teachers and other school staff, that did not make it into the recommendations. The group also made several recommendations concerning mental health, including investing in more counselors, which Strand says they stress are not interchangeable with school resource officers.
School resource officers and counselors can be viewed as an either-or, and the fact is that both are very, very critical for a safe environment within a school and for threat assessment. So school resource officers are certainly a great benefit. Don't put too much emphasis, however, on, you know, when you think about an active shooter, that it's going to prevent every one of those incidents. It is not. It's really about threat assessment, getting to know the students, and then hopefully preventing and doing something about these things before they occur.
And the group says having accessible mental health services like counselors can help stop mass shootings before they happen. Their recommendations push for new training for teachers and other staff to recognize concerning behavior, as well as encouraging students from kindergarten all the way through college to report suspicious behavior, and that they be trained on what kind of behavior they should be looking for and what triggers that kind of reporting of a see something, say something thing. They also want the legislature to pay for a see something, say something campaign. Now, Strand admits that that raises some concerns about a lot of things like profiling and the long-term effects of threatening behavior on a student.
School shootings are incredibly concerning. Make sure that we do something about it. At the same time, we're talking about students. In many cases, not adults yet. We should be able to respond appropriately to threats, respond appropriately to comments that are concerning so that we can begin to reduce the potential of mass shootings. But at the same time, we shouldn't be creating a situation where a student, based upon doing one thing, is labeled or has something that follows them into adulthood or that gets them off track educationally.
And another major recommendation would be having all schools in the state conduct active shooter drills, which includes kindergarten all the way through college.
They can be effective if, God forbid, it occurs. I think that the school in Texas where there was a school shooting, that some of the experience there was that because they had done some training, that it was very helpful and reduced potentially deaths and injuries. You know, it seems to certainly make sense on the face of it, but it also, I think, gets students and staff into that mindset of let's be safe, let's not be scared, but let's be safe and let's know what to do. The worst thing is not knowing what to do.
But he says the recommendations also include making sure that training is age appropriate and different in the various grade levels from kindergarten through college, so the kids aren't scared of what they're learning.
Well, what do you say? I mean, I assume the drills even for kindergarten mentioned that, okay, if you hear gunshots, here's what you do, right?
Right. And I think, you know, when you're talking about all the way up to what a college situation, perhaps training might include what might you do to intervene.
I mean?
So there's a variety of different things.
That's part of it, right? Well, or is that part of it? Because my understanding now is that you don't just cower. if you sense a pause, you all grab your chairs, your desks, and attack.
And attack. There's an acronym for that. I can't think of it off the top of my head, but there definitely is. So, and they don't make any recommendations, I should say, about that in here. Other quick recommendations we've discussed before is the extension of the ERPO, Extreme Risk Protection Order, to involve minors, and also a change in state law that makes it for anyone who violates an ERPO for a second time and has a gun when they're not supposed to, they will permanently lose their gun rights if this recommendation went through.
Is that at all controversial?
I'm sure. Yes, it's the first time I've seen it floated, so it will have to be, absolutely, I would speculate, be a controversial thing for your gun rights folks, which I also want to point out, we're not invited to be part of this work group.
We're not?
No. And I asked Strand about that, and he said, you know, the idea here is these are recommendations to the legislature. They will likely, at least some of them come in the form of legislation that's proposed, and he expects that those gun rights folks will be involved in that.
Well, now, was it bipartisan, though?
It was absolutely bipartisan.
There were Republicans on this.
There were. Republican Senator Steve O'Bannon is the one who got this passed and created this work group. And
so it was a Republican idea.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Democrat David Frost.
And the gun rights groups don't consider themselves represented by that?
No,
simple
they
factor.
Just they weren't. They would have preferred to have a seat at the table. Mm-hmm. We've got the mental health, the ACLU, law enforcement, and I think they wanted to weigh in on this. But again, Strand says that they should be able to when we see legislation that would come out of this.
Now, I also heard you mention during the report that this group also decided against arming teachers.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes. That was one of many things that they discussed during their 9 meetings that they had over the last several months. It's a subject that came up, and it's a subject that did not make the cut. I don't know that it ever was going to make the cut, but that wasn't a direction they wanted to recommend in our state.
But again, that did not make the cut, even though this was a bipartisan group in which conservative viewpoints were presumably represented.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Choke Points.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. Lost in all the Alaskan Way Viaduct and Tunnel talk is what's going to happen to the Battery Street Tunnel. Oh, I'm sure that was the center of more than just a few dinner conversations last night. Let's get the final plan here. What's happening?
Were you in my kitchen with my wife discussing what's happening with the Battery Street Tunnel? You know, there have been some last-minute attempts that we've talked about before to try to save the Battery Street Tunnel. Some believe that it would just be a waste to fill in that real estate. Advocates have proposed turning it into a park or a bike or pedestrian throughway. None of that's going to happen. The 64-year-old Battery Street Tunnel is going to be filled in. A lot of that fill is going to be coming from the broken-down concrete of the demolished Alaskan Way Viaduct. Phil Wallace of the demolition contractor Kiewit says that they have to remove all the metal rebar first, and then that concrete's going to head into the tunnel.
Because as we leave the area, we're going to actually use that rubble. We're going to take it down to Terminal 25, crush it down to 3-inch minus, and put it in the tunnel.
3-inch minus, by the way, for those of you that aren't in the construction business, means that the concrete's going to be crushed into pieces that are 3 inches or less in size. They could fit through a 3-inch sieve. That's the way they measure that kind of stuff. Now you know. Wallace says all of that debris will fill the base of the 2,000-foot-long tunnel.
And then we'll bring it up to about a 10-foot plus or minus level within a tunnel. And then the tunnel from that to the top is filled with what they call a cellular concrete.
This type of concrete is easier to dig into should the city need to put in utilities through that area in the future.
Why don't they just build in a conduit, you know, like a pipe they could shoot wires through if they had
to? Well, because they don't know exactly where things might go in the future, so they're going to have all that level area from 10 feet up to the top of the tunnel to be able to figure out where they want to go with it. And this kind of foam concrete mix is a little bit easier for them to work their way through. Now, we don't have the final timeline for when the filling in of the Battery Street Tunnel is going to happen or when it's going to be finished. Wallace says they do have some work to do on utilities first.
There's a lot of work we got to do in the tunnel before we can place material in there. There's a lot of utilities we got to reroute. So all of that'll go on before any of that material goes in there.
So your last chance to drive through the Battery Street Tunnel, if you're the, I don't know, sentimental kind, will be January 10th. It's going to close for good, just like the Alaskan Way Viaduct, on January 11th.
Okay. I drove through it this morning because the ramp to I-5 was closed, so I had
to. You like that better? It's kind of with the
ugly
tiling on the
it's
side.
Old school.
It's beautiful.
It's old school.
No, yeah, it is really.
It's like
really
those New York
ugly
tunnels.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which haven't changed since the 20s. Politics and the special counsel probe into Russia. We haven't talked with our information warfare expert, Molly McHugh, since the latest guilty plea with the president's lawyer admitted to lying to Congress.
You know, I think we've seen sort of an escalating series of, well, what do we really know about this? Oh, it turns out we know a lot. on multiple fronts. I think, you know, on Friday, we're expecting a new court document on the Manafort case. There was the filing on the Flynn sentencing this week. There were the new revelations around Cohen. I think across the board, what we've seen is that Mueller's team has put together a very meticulous case on a variety of fronts based on financial information and intercept information and other sort of concrete things that have been, in some cases, advanced by or reinforced by cooperating witnesses. But I think that the sense, certainly in Washington, is that this is building momentum towards a pretty big and significant case that will come down.
And does it have the fingerprints of some kind of intentional Russian operation to compromise people? Or is this just these are just business feelers that didn't pan out on the part of the Trump organization?
Well, I think even if you take sort of the Trump family rebuttal to this at face value, which is, or even the president's own statement on this, which I thought was really extraordinary, which was, well, we thought we would lose. So what does it matter if we were continuing to pursue our business interests during this time? And it matters because in all of those things, it has been clear that whether we're talking about Russia or the UAE or Saudi Arabia or Israel, on a number of cases, the Trump family, including the son-in-law, Jared Kushner, have made it very clear that their business interests come before the priorities of the United States of America, whether they be economic or national security related, whether that be during the campaign or now. And I think it's both of those questions that are super interesting in the sense of, were they making promises to people that they were talking to during the campaign, believing perhaps that it was just in their own business and best business interest to make those promises? Or were they looking forward to and sort of projecting that forward to now? Are they still doing the same thing now?
Yeah, that's the more important question, is President Trump somehow still compromised by Russia today? So is he?
When you're looking at the way this administration has been dealing with specific target countries where the Trump family seems to have financial interests, it is very hard to say that those financial interests are not influencing how they deal with countries and how they make decisions. I think the interesting thing in the Russia case is this sort of 30-year Trump romance. The idea of building a Trump Tower in Moscow is sort of become, and in the case of the Cohen case, you know, this has sort of become this focus that everybody is looking at. And while that is important, I think the vastly more important aspect to this, like, Russia doesn't need Trump to invest in Russia. Better question is, what has Russia been investing in Trump? And I think on that side, where there is significant evidence of Russian investment in Trump properties, of money laundering through Trump-branded properties over a significant period of time, in many cases, those transactions facilitated by Russian or Russian-American real estate brokers who have long connections to the Trump family and the Trump organization, there's probably a lot more in there than I think anybody really wants to look at.
Well, are you implying that, for example, Russia did this in hopes of getting away what it appears to be trying to get away with against Ukraine, cutting off their shipping and threatening them?
Across the board for many decades, but in particular over the last 10 years, Russia has understood exactly how powerful the export of their stolen money is, whether it be moving money through and into the UK, into New York, Miami, other American cities, the investments in lobbying and PR and trips for foreign officials and business deals and investments in Silicon Valley. None of this is accidental. Like, yes, Russia's trying to make money the same as everybody else, but they have had a targeted strategy of buying silence and complicity from Western allied nations in order to facilitate their state goals. And we just need to be much more clear about this, that oligarchs are not sort of independent actors just out for their own best profit. They have state-driven goals that they are mandated to achieve. And when a Russian oligarch is investing in Facebook, we should care about that.
Russia expert and information warfare expert Molly McHugh frequently writes for The Atlantic. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We've talked a lot about the trade war with China, and we're a little bit confused as to where it stands right now after President Trump's meeting with the Chinese President Xi Jinping. We have someone, though, who might be able to shed some light on this. He's Brad Merg. He teaches at Seattle Pacific University. Tell me a little bit about your journey. How did you become so immersed Asia?
Oh, sure. Right after university, I went to the Asian Development Bank as a Henry Luce scholar focusing on law and development. I spent a lot of time working in Southeast and South Asia and eventually thought, well, China's growing, China's the future, and whatever region I want to know, I'm going to have to know what's going on in Beijing. So eventually learned Mandarin and did my PhD over at UW. Yeah.
To the tariffs, was China eating our lunch?
No. There are areas where China has not played by the rules, and there is significant and legitimate backlash towards that. I mean, protection of intellectual property rights, by far, number one. A huge question. There have been improvements, but not nearly the improvements that America...
So they're still ripping us off.
In certain areas, absolutely. There's distinct areas where there are completely valid complaints against China as not basically upholding its obligations to trade agreements and so on and so forth. So there are valid critiques, and I think you can critique China, and one should critique China's trade approach, but that doesn't necessarily go into the response that the United States has made at this point.
Who is... You're saying this did surprise China?
Absolutely.
They were not prepared for this?
Not remotely.
They didn't pay attention to what Trump was saying during his campaign, or they didn't believe he'd do it?
This is... Remember, hitting China with a stick is a big part of U.S. election campaigns for a while. Everybody heard it. The expectation was, all right, this is something for public consumption, this is something for an election, but it's not really going to go anywhere. And even when it began, that it would go this far.
They're convinced now, though?
Absolutely.
Okay, so who's going to win this?
The impacts are significantly more negative for China than for the United States, at least in terms of its growth prospects in the short to medium term. The most simple piece of evidence that I find intriguing was an interview a few months ago with the Chinese Minister of Finance, who stated that China was already preparing billions and billions of dollars in new spending to offset the anticipated rise in unemployment. High levels of unemployment are a significant concern for the Chinese government. So when they saw that the tariffs were hitting, and they saw as an export-based economy that there was no place else to send these products, no place else that no market large enough to basically take this amount that China's producing, then we saw significant concern bordering on panic in terms of how much China was going to put into its economy, the billions that China would spend to try to offset a rise of unemployment up to maybe 5.8 or 6%. This is a problem for the state's interest and the states, if it goes on long term, the state's ultimate stability.
So even in a one party state, they're worried about public opinion.
Absolutely. The Chinese government has basically an implicit bargain with the population. The party gets to maintain control. The party maintains political control. But hey, your life is going to get better. You're going to get a nicer apartment. You're going to get a car. You're going to have that nice vacation to Southeast
Asia. And that depends on trade with America.
That enormously. China has tried to build up domestic demand in recent years. It's done a ton to work to get its consumers to buy things. And there have been some benefits there. But by and large, this is a country where the economy is fundamentally dependent upon exports and is dependent upon the U.S. market.
So we have the upper hand. The president knows what he's doing.
I wouldn't say that necessarily. That might be slightly overly generous, but not to be too. There are areas where the U.S. can exert significant pressure. And China has come back to the United States with multiple offers saying, OK, we'll do X, we'll do Y, we'll do Z, and so on and so forth, which have been consistently rejected. We are seeing significant knock-on effects in the United States. I mean, we obviously see the responses from the U.S. automakers and so on and so forth as to how they're feeling the impacts of the tariffs.
Well, let's talk about whether there is reciprocity, whether there's fair treatment on both sides or not. The president has complained that we basically flung open the doors to Chinese products, but China has still been slapping tariffs on our products. Is that true?
Absolutely. So China has protected certain markets. One of the big complaints is that the service industry, areas where the U.S. does have what we call comparative advantage in the production of certain goods or the provision of certain services, China has not opened those markets. So when we look at financial services and so on and so forth, things where American firms would have a significant...
So we can't open banks in there?
China has protected its...
What about cars?
Markets. We have, there's a joint venture system. Systems, but no, you could not have a solely foreign-owned firm within, and that's become a major bone of contention.
So, can you ship American cars to China?
You have a joint venture system where you can't export, but basically the American auto industry as it operates within China is a joint venture with a local firm essentially, and this has become a huge area of critique for the U.S. administration as to how that can be resolved. And while Washington does have significant leverage, and I think in the last 2 or 3 months could have made a very, very good deal with China. The question now is, well, is that deal ever going to come? Are we actually going to see any point where what China offers is good enough for the United States? And China is beginning to wonder. That's the question you get in Beijing is, well, what do the Americans want? We've offered this, we've offered that. Mm-hmm. What can we do? So it is, if we were going to seek in a positive way about sort of Trump's approach, it has flummoxed Beijing. The question of how to respond is out there.
Brad Merg teaches at Seattle Pacific University. Thanks very much, Brad.
Thank you.
Also included in the podcast now, The Daily Dose of Kindness. If you want to hear it again, just go to that. This Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Spring Free Trampoline. It's out of the Pierce County Sheriff's Office. They tweeted out a sweet thank you note they received from who they call their new friend, Christy. It's about how two of their deputies assisted an elderly man in need. Christy wrote to them, "I work in customer service for a local cable company. Today, I received a call from Deputy Roberts and Deputy Holznagel, who were at the home of one of our elderly customers because his TV didn't work, and he didn't have a telephone. The deputies helped the customers to arrange to have his service reconnected, and those two deputies drove his payment to the cable company's lobby right away so he could get his service hooked up by the next day, and they even brought him back his change. I am very familiar with this customer from him coming into the lobby over the last few years. He's a very sweet man. It warms my heart that these officers went this far above and beyond the call of duty to provide some comfort to him, as he is a widower, and TV often provides companionship for our older customers. Thanks to both of them. Christy." The Pierce County Sheriff's Office continues in their tweet, "We are exceptionally proud of our deputies for their kindness and their compassion. It is who we are. It is what we do."
Now it's time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And now here he is in his down jacket and stocking cap, having just landed on the roof and stepped off that overstuffed sleigh of sports, 710 ESPN Seattle, Danny O'Neill.
I just saw a poor sucker out there trying to clean his windshield with a sponge.
Doesn't work.
No.
What?
Yeah. He had a dish sponge out there
unless
trying
the sponge
to scrub
has
on the front.
On it.
Yeah. It's like, that's not going to help you,
homie. Why not pour hot water on the windshield while you're at it? Jeez.
That'd be good. There have been rumors for a while, but apparently we're not just getting hockey. We're getting the XFL.
That's right.
Unlimited football.
The XFL's coming to town. I'm interested to see what this is going to look like. They're going to play outdoors. They're going to play at CenturyLink Field.
Wow.
We still don't know the specifics of how the teams are going to be chosen, who's going to be on the teams. We know they're going to test for PEDs. That was something that the commissioner all overlooks. And we know Seattle's going to get a team.
So the XFL tried to launch before, right?
They did. They played a couple seasons.
So it went bankrupt?
Yes. They ran out of...
So this is a brand new organization, though?
No, it's backed by the same people. McMahon, the WWE, the pro wrestling poobah in the country, is the guy that's at the head of it. The last time they did it, there was sort of this... It was neither fish nor fowl. It wasn't good enough football for the football fan. It wasn't enough over-the-top theatric pro wrestling for the pro wrestling fan. Uh-huh. And they marketed it last time as, like, there are no rules. There's, like, scantily clad cheerleaders and controversial announcers. Like, all these... we're going to put the violence back in the NFL, in football. That doesn't seem to be the direction they're going this time around. So I'll be interested to see, because there was the big, no one will be kneeling for the anthem. It was kind of that sort of thing.
Like, is it going to be concussion friendly? Or
it's football, right?
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out. They're not going to be overtly violent, but are they going to be like less snowflake than the NFL?
They have not marketed snowflake.
Ooh, you know
Look
what I mean.
At you. Are you trying to own the libs with language?
Are you speaking for the mainstream media establishment? Is that who you are?
Oh, I have no idea. Yeah. Yeah. The fake news that's here. They have not marketed it in, we're going to put the big hits back in football, and the NFL is too soft, and we're going to put... They haven't marketed it that way.
Then what's their niche?
I don't know. So far,
we know nothing. Do we know, though, because when I was over in Spokane, there was arena football, and it was the first time I'd been exposed to arena football. It was actually a lot of fun, and their fan base was a lot of fun. So is this sort of like that? Do you think it could be popular enough?
It's on a bigger scale. They're doing it in outdoor stadiums. I agree with you. Arena football is a great product.
Yeah.
But it's also in smaller arenas.
Yeah, half the field.
So you get kind of a more condensed, it feels more energetic. If you put those crowds in an outdoor stadium, Like, if you got that fan base that you have for the Arena Football League and put it at CenturyLink Field, it'd feel really small. Like, you'd feel
why are
a
they
lack
playing
of
outdoors
energy.
Then for the XFL?
I don't know.
Yeah.
And I think it's part of their marketing plan. I just finished a book on the USFL, which was another league that started in the 80s. Trump was involved in it.
Huh.
And I remember the USFL growing up, and it was actually great for football. It helped increase player salaries. They did a lot of different things like the use of instant replay. But that league ended up going bankrupt, too.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see. You have this, and then you also have the Alliance of American Football that will also be launching that is a different model. That is trying to become more of a developmental league for the NFL.
Like a farm team.
As opposed to the XFL, which is going to be a different football league.
Oh, so then we can stop harvesting university players and have an actual farm
Nobody's
league,
huh? the Alliance of American Football has said they're not even going to take guys with college eligibility remaining. That's what I'm waiting for, is one of those leagues to say, hey, if you want to come here and play at 19 years old, and instead of going to college, you play for us, and then 3 years you're eligible.
That'd be more honest anyway.
I'd be really interested to see how many people you would get doing that.
Can we talk about the Mariner player that you spent some time with?
Yeah.
We didn't get to that yesterday. Malik Smith?
Malik Smith. He's fantastic.
Where's he coming from? Who is he? What's he do?
He's coming from the Tampa Bay Rays.
Okay.
He was a Mariner for about 45 minutes last offseason. The Mariners traded for him, but then they traded him as part of another deal. And when they got him, Jerry DePoto even told him, look, you're either going to Tampa Bay or the Dodgers. We're not sure which, but you're going to one of those spots. And so we asked him about what was it like to be a Mariner. He's like, oh, the fans were great, the front office. So he had a real sense of humor about it. And then we asked him why he wears zero. He goes, do you want the politically correct answer or the real answer? Mm. And it was like, well, give us the politically correct one. He goes, it fits my personality, you know, that I'm different. It just seems like it's right. It's a little weird. I'm a little weird. And I'm like, okay, what's the real reason? And he said, because I give zero figs about what anybody thinks about me.
All
I've
right.
been doubted for a long time. Oh. And as soon as he said it, I was like, oh my gosh, this guy's the best.
Love him.
It was a fantastically delivered answer. It was great.
Does that show up on the field, though?
I think he plays with a joy and an enthusiasm. And it wasn't that, hey, I don't care about anybody else. It was, I'm not going to let other people's opinions of my skills define me. Mm-hmm. And he sounds like he's got a great energy. Look, it's going to be a tough year for the Mariners next year. Mm-hmm. They're going to win 70 games. And
so they better have a sense of humor, is what you're saying.
But there are going to be young players. Like, you can hope that Malik Smith is part of this core going forward. And I've not bought a Mariners jersey before. Mm-hmm. I'm going to buy a Malik Smith jersey.
Wow,
with a
what
big
an
zero.
No, that's the way to address this coming season. Build a team of personalities.
Yeah.
What did I say at the beginning of last season?
Well, of course, she predicted.
I said
too.
We're missing the PR around our stars. We need to connect with our players personally to root for them on the field.
Our Sports Insider is sponsored by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank
vindicated.
You, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
All right. The leader of a prolific prostitution website that operated with Asian-born prostitutes in high-class apartments in Bellevue and Seattle is being sentenced this morning. Chi Radio's Hannah Scott says this was an elaborate, tech-savvy operation where Johns were reviewing and exchanging information about women who had been forced into prostitution.
A total of 33 men were arrested in connection with the massive prostitution bust where Korean women were forced to live in luxury apartment buildings in Bellevue and Seattle and advertised online on a website where Johns could exchange Yelp-like reviews of the women's services. Charles Peters was recently convicted on a variety of charges for running the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen website, and his sentencing will mark the close of a three-year-old case that led to dozens of arrests in January of 2016 after an undercover King County Sheriff's detective managed to infiltrate the ring. The men using the site started on a separate site, thereviewboard.com, where prostitutes were promoted across the country and that had up to 20,000 members. They were then recruited from that site as elite Johns to the more exclusive League of Extraordinary Gentlemen site, where they were dubbed elite hobbyists. At the time, then King County Sheriff John Urquhart described why busting this site was so important.
This one was shut down because of its connection to the human trafficking of these Asian women that were brought here illegally, that were held against their will, that were essentially sex slaves.
He said the 12 women who were being prostituted and promoted by Peters and others were rarely allowed to leave their apartments and advertised as available for work up to 14 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week.
It is also connected part and parcel to the human trafficking that was going on with these 12 Korean women that we rescued from a life of prostitution and rape. And this particular website is connected very closely to that. The men that run that website and the other second one that we took down are keeping these women in bondage and using the website to sell the services to come and prostitute these women.
Urquhart also described how prospective Johns were screened to get into the FirstSiteReviewBoard.com.
Most cases required to furnish a business email and a photo of their driver's license. And then, of course, the people at the other end at the review board would erase all of that.
It was that site the undercover cop infiltrated and, according to court records, was eventually allowed access to the league site after a series of meet and greets with promoters to screen for good Johns, some of whom were buying sex several times a week. During those meetings, members would also detail descriptions of their encounters with their dates and also discuss ways to find a new local apartment to use for prostitution as a brothel. Cops linked many of the 33 arrested to the operation through emails and the undercover operation. Most pleaded guilty and avoided jail time. A second-in-command also pleaded guilty to promoting prostitution and was sentenced to 75 days last week. Peters, the leader of the ring, went to trial and was convicted in October on 9 counts of promoting prostitution. Prosecutors are recommending a 4-year sentence for him this morning. As far as the prostitutes,
make no mistake about it, these women are victims. And we wanted to rescue them out of that horrible life that they found themselves in.
None of those prostitutes were arrested.
Anna Scott, there were 13 brothels being operated from 7 different apartment buildings and townhomes. And it began when a resident at the Avalon Maidenbauer Apartments on Northeast 2nd Street in Bellevue heard something suspicious going on next door, called police, and it unraveled from there. Pretty amazing story.